Welcome back to What's New in Astronomy. In this lecture, I'd like to discuss the birth and evolution of galaxies, gigantic systems of stars like our Milky Way. Now, in the previous lecture, I gave you at least two techniques that we use to determine the age of the universe: the expansion rate, extrapolated backwards in time, and the ages of stars, as determined using a variety of techniques. Both of those techniques give an answer of something like 13.5 to 14 billion years, and I said 13.7. Well, in fact, yet another technique that I'll discuss in Lecture 13 really nails that number to something like 13.7 plus or minus 0.2 billion years. That's the age of the universe as we have now determined it. That means we can look back in time 13.7 billion years. That's how long back in time we can see. And so the birth of galaxies occurred at some point since the birth of the universe, between now and 13.7 billion years ago. How do we view the birth of galaxies? How do we see them when they were just being born? And how do we watch them evolve? Well, by looking to greater and greater distances, we're seeing back into the past. Light takes time to travel from here to there. I'm seeing people in this room as you were a few billionths of a second ago, because light travels about a foot per billionth of a second. I'm seeing the sun as it was a little over 8 minutes ago, because it took that long for light to travel from the sun to me. We see even the nearest stars in the sky as they were a few years ago, and more distant stars tens or hundreds of years ago, and distant galaxies millions or even billions of years ago. So by looking at galaxies that are billions of light years away, we can see back in time billions of years to when the universe was young. And the hope is to see as far back in time, as far back out of those 13.7 billion years as we can. In a picture of the Hubble Deep Field, seen here, you can detect lots of faint galaxies, and their spectra give their redshifts, 0.32, 2.27, and so on. Using the Hubble relationship of the expanding universe, you can figure out the distance, or more precisely, the look-back time of a galaxy of a given redshift. There's a direct correspondence between redshift and the amount of time over which light has been traveling from that galaxy to us, the amount of stretching that has occurred to the light rays from that galaxy. And in fact, if we make a table of look-back time, often called distance, versus redshift, it looks something like this. At a redshift of zero, that's right now. It's a look-back time of 0 years. Redshift of 0.1 corresponds to a look-back time of 1.3 billion years, often called a distance, but really it's a look-back time, 0.2 to 2.4 billion years, and so on. For example, redshift 5 corresponds to 12.5 billion years ago, and redshift 7 to 12.9 billion years ago. So the idea is, if we find galaxies at progressively larger redshifts, the look-back time is progressively longer. In newspapers, this is called the distance of the galaxy, but distance over such vast distances is an ambiguous term, because the universe has been expanding since the light was emitted by the galaxy. So does the distance correspond to the distance the galaxy had when the light was emitted, or the distance that the galaxy has now, or some intermediate distance? It's ambiguous. What's not ambiguous is how long it took the photons, the light, to travel from there to here. And that's why astronomers use look-back time for such large distances instead of the more ambiguous distance term. Well, when we look back in the universe, back in time, we're seeing galaxies as they were when the universe was a lot younger. So we can not only see how they were born, but we can see them as they evolve with time. We do have to make the assumption that typical galaxies today evolved from typical galaxies billions of years ago, just like the typical adults of today evolved from typical children, typical babies. You study the evolution of a population of objects in this way. And by looking back in time at typical galaxies long ago, and by assuming that our galaxies now were basically the same as typical galaxies long ago, we can come to some understanding of what our galaxy and other local galaxies looked like long ago. So, we take pictures of galaxies at progressively greater distances, and we look at their appearance. But that's hard to do. Here's a relatively nearby galaxy, only 30 million light years away. But when you place that galaxy at a distance of 300 million light years, there are fewer details visible. And at 3 billion light years, there are fewer details still. So the farther away an object is, the less clearly you see it. The stars are jumbled more closely together from your perspective. So how do we see these distant galaxies clearly? Well, it helps to have a big telescope. It's especially helpful if that big telescope is up in space. And the Hubble Space Telescope has been really good, but the successor to that telescope, the Next Generation Space Telescope, now named the Webb Next Generation Space Telescope, will be even bigger than today's Hubble Space Telescope and will see even more clearly far, far back in time. We can also see more clearly if nature provides a telescope for us, a lens that magnifies the light and makes it brighter. So if we have a cluster of galaxies between the Earth and a distant galaxy, then that cluster, especially if it's filled with lots of dark matter, can bend the light from the more distant galaxy, magnify it, and allow us to see galaxies that would otherwise be too distant, too faint to be seen. And in this animation, you can see that, in fact, the galaxies got stretched out into streaks. Here's one of the best gravitational lenses that has yet been found. This giant cluster of galaxies lends the light of a very faint, more distant galaxy and stretched that light. Here you can see blobs and streaks. They've been stretched and magnified, allowing us to study those galaxies with this cosmic telescope. It sort of replaces or is a good substitute for a real telescope that magnifies the light and collects a lot of light for us. The universe can produce these cosmic space telescopes. And here's an even better one, an even bigger, denser cluster of galaxies, and you can see all sorts of arc-like structures that it has lensed. These are distant galaxies whose shapes have admittedly been distorted by the lensing process. So we can't believe these shapes. But we can believe the spectra of these galaxies, which show us the chemical elements that had been synthesized by nuclear reactions in stars. And we can determine all sorts of other things about these galaxies, such as the rate at which stars were forming back then. So these telescopes distort the images, and you can't necessarily use the shapes of galaxies that have passed through a gravitational lens, but you do get a lot of other very useful information from lensed images of this sort. I should add that in the previous lecture, I showed you a gravitationally lensed image of a quasar. It looked like four or five points, whereas these galaxies look stretched into arcs. That's because quasars are intrinsically point-like objects. They're a supermassive black hole surrounded by an accretion disk. They're small compared to galaxies, which are large. So galaxies get imaged into arcs. Quasars get imaged into points. But this gravitational lensing technique is very important, and it has shown us baby pictures of galaxies. Here they are, galaxies 7, 9, 10 billion years ago. In a few of these cases, this one right here, we think the galaxy is being seen as it was 11 or 12 billion years ago. And what we deduce from these images and other images like it is that giant galaxies like our own used to be a whole bunch of little bits and pieces of galaxies, little things like this, much smaller than our Milky Way currently is. And over time, apparently these small galaxies coalesced into bigger structures giant galaxies like ours and the Andromeda Galaxy and others, because the baby pictures don't reveal big galaxies. Long, long ago, the big galaxies didn't exist. Now, at intermediate distances, you see what we think are intermediate stages in this merging process. These four galaxies look quite peculiar. We think that they were produced when building blocks, like the ones I showed you in the previous image, came together, collided, and merged, forming what we like to call train wrecks in astronomy. Of course, these aren't train wrecks, but they look very strange compared to the more orderly galaxies of today. So the merging process was apparently very important, and so we can study it nearby in order to get a better idea of how it may have occurred in detail long ago. Here's a nearby pair of galaxies that is in the process of merging. You can see that these tidal tails have been formed. I'll show an animation of that in a minute. And there's all sorts of star clusters here. They're all over the place. Apparently, the merging of two galaxies and the shoving together of clouds of gas in those galaxies leads to rampant star formation within those merging galaxies. And we think that this rampant star formation that we see in nearby galaxies, here's another example, also occurred when subunits of galaxies merged together in the distant past. Here's a more close-up view of a region in which there's been intense star formation. The merging galaxies have formed what's called a superstar cluster, a whole bunch of stars that were formed at about the same time in about the same place. Here's an animation of two nearby galaxies that have been interacting. When we look deep into one of those galaxies that's particularly filled with gas and dust, and especially if we peer at it with infrared wavelengths, we can see a whole bunch of these star clusters, superstar clusters, that seem to have formed as a result of the interaction of that galaxy with the other galaxy. So you don't even necessarily need for them to merge completely. They just have to gravitationally interact, and that tends to induce the formation of new stars in these gigantic clusters. Let's see what happens when they really do merge, though. You get a whole bunch of stuff forming. Here are two galaxies that have merged together, and huge numbers of stars have formed inside this galaxy. Lots of dust has formed as well, little fine particles. And indeed, this galaxy, called ARP 220, emits most of its radiation at infrared wavelengths. The optical and ultraviolet radiation emitted by stars has been soaked up by dust, smog, within this interacting pair of galaxies, and it's being re-radiated as heat energy, infrared light. Kind of a cool object. Well, studies of extremely distant galaxies can be made by taking deep photographs of the sky, such as those shown here, and looking for objects that look particularly red. Here are objects around which squares are drawn that are visible in pictures taken through a red filter, and they're also visible in pictures taken through a green filter, but they're invisible in pictures taken through an ultraviolet filter. There's a couple of reasons for this. They're very distant, so their light is redshifted by the expansion of space. Moreover, there are clouds of gas between us and these very distant galaxies that tend to absorb the ultraviolet radiation from those galaxies. Clouds of hydrogen just gobble up ultraviolet radiation like there's no tomorrow, producing a deficit of ultraviolet rays coming from these galaxies and not a deficit of red electromagnetic radiation. So one way to look for distant galaxies is to look for objects that are invisible in the ultraviolet but visible at other wavelengths. And many astronomers have now done this, and in the past few years, our view of the formation history of galaxies and stars has changed quite dramatically. In this graph, you can see the star formation rate plotted versus time in the past. Here we are at about 14 billion years. There's the Big Bang at 0 years. We used to think that star formation was more prevalent farther back into the past. peaked when the universe was maybe 3 or 4 billion years old, and then tapered off to nearly zero at 0.5 billion years or 1 billion years. But recent discoveries of many, many distant galaxies and studies of the star formation rate in those galaxies shows that, in fact, the star formation rate kept on increasing as you go back in time. So, in fact, there was a huge amount of star formation shortly after the universe was born, 0.5 billion to 1 billion years after it was born. And since that time, the star formation rate has gradually tapered down. So instead of there being a peak in the star formation rate at about 4 billion years after the Big Bang, the peak was actually after about maybe 1 billion years, and it has been tapering down since then. That's a discovery that's been made just in the past couple of years. If we now look at these interacting galaxies more closely, we can see that when they merge together like this, the galaxies essentially fuse. The stars don't hit each other, but they do gravitationally interact with one another. And they form these tidal tails, we call them, as in this pair of galaxies known as the MICE. Here's an animation of what the MICE were produced by. It's a computer simulation of two galaxies coming together with millions of stars within both of them. They come together, they interact, form an object that looks a lot like the MICE. And now, as we project into the future, that pair of galaxies will continue to interact, continue to merge, and gradually form a more spherical, more regular-looking system. This looks irregular because there's still lots of streamers here, but with time, even those will go away. Here's a tidal tail emerging from a galaxy that clearly has suffered a fairly recent interaction. Our own Milky Way galaxy will merge in this manner with the Andromeda galaxy in about 6 billion years, 6 or 7 billion years. So here's our largest near neighbor, only 2.5 million light years away. We're gravitationally bound to one another, and we will merge. And the merging process will look something like this. This particular set of calculations was done specifically for the properties of the Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy. So there are these two disks. They're gradually passing each other. And as they pass one another, the stars don't actually collide, but they gravitationally interact. They pull on each other in such a way as to draw out these tidal tails or these streamers of stars. So this is the future of our Milky Way. Perhaps it won't look like this in detail. We don't know exactly the approach parameters of the two galaxies. You know, we know about how quickly Andromeda is coming towards us, but we don't know its transverse motion. So we don't know in detail that this is what our pair of galaxies will look like. But in broad terms, this is how Andromeda and the Milky Way will merge. Later on in time, our whole local group of galaxies will merge. We live in a group of galaxies consisting of perhaps 1 or 2 dozen galaxies that looks kind of like this group in this computer animation. And after Andromeda and our Milky Way merge, the other galaxies in our group will begin to merge with our super galaxy, our Milky Way Andromeda super galaxy. And all these galaxies will slowly come together, passing each other numerous times, becoming more and more tightly bound. There's still an outlier way off to the upper left, but most of them have kind of merged together. And with time, essentially all the galaxies in our local group of galaxies will have merged into truly one big super galaxy. This is sort of a process of galactic cannibalism almost. You see, there were many galaxies at first. Now there is one. And usually, the initial dominant galaxy in the group becomes the super galaxy that eats all others. And of course, as we saw in a previous lecture, whatever black holes were in those individual galaxies will merge together and form a super duper massive black hole in this final galaxy. So that's the future of our local group in broad generality. We see other groups like this. Here's one that's in the process of merging. It too will become one galaxy in some tens or 20 billion years. Yet another group is this one. This one is at a fairly advanced stage of merging. This one might become one supergalaxy in fewer than 10 billion years. So this is how galaxies merge and evolve with time. So you see, we've gone back into the past and seen young galaxies and watched how they evolve with time by looking at galaxies at many different distances. And using the data that we've gathered and the knowledge that we've gathered, we've run computer simulations to predict what will become of our galaxy and others in the future. So this now means we have a pretty good understanding of the broad generalities of galaxy evolution, though a lot of the details are still completely unknown, or at least quite uncertain. To make further progress in the field, we now want to ask the question, how did those first building blocks of galaxies form? How did the first little shreds that later came together to form big galaxies, how did they form? How did the first stars form? Before the first stars and galaxies formed, the universe was dark in the sense that there was no starlight present. There was still light from the Big Bang, from the hot birth of the universe, but it was dark in the sense of there being an absence of new light from stars. We call those ages the dark ages, before the birth of stars and galaxies. We'd like to go to a time during and before the dark ages in order to understand the process by which matter clumped together in the first place to form the building blocks, the pieces of galaxies from which galaxies later formed through the merging process. To do this, we have to go quite far back in time, back to a time when the universe was very hot and very dense. According to the Big Bang theory, the universe is now expanding. We see it expanding. It's also cooling. Extrapolating back into the past, it must have been denser, hotter, according to the Big Bang theory. But do we have any direct evidence that this was indeed the case? Was it really hotter? Was it really very, very dense? Is the Big Bang theory correct? Well, let's go back to a time when we think the universe was so hot that it was glowing uniformly with a very high temperature. At that time, the typical wavelengths of light were ultraviolet or even X-rays. And as the universe expanded and cooled, the wavelengths became longer, optical, infrared, that kind of a thing. As the universe cooled, this radiation expanded. It should now be visible. It should still be visible, right? If it was there in the past and it stretched with time, like in my expanding balloon, the radiation from the hot, dense Big Bang should still be visible. Do we see it? Indeed, we do. It was discovered by Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson using an AT&T Bell Labs antenna that had previously been used for communications. They were studying our galaxy and the radio radiation coming from it, and they discovered a persistent noise, a hiss, coming from all parts of the sky, uniformly. They did not know what this hiss was. They tried to explain it away as noise within their electronic system, but it wouldn't go away. It was there all the time, everywhere, a background radiation of microwaves. Radio waves. You can detect this radiation on your TV set. Just tune it to a non-existent channel, and some of the stuff that you see on that non-existent channel is due to photons from the microwave background radiation from the birth of the universe, stretched by a large amount to form radio waves, which are detected by your TV and radio antenna, producing mindless noise like what you sometimes see on daytime TV or reality TV. Well, what is the physical origin of that cosmic microwave background radiation? I said it was the hot gas that produced photons, that produced electromagnetic radiation. But why did it ever become free to traverse the universe? Why wasn't it always stuck, bouncing around in this hot plasma? Well, what happened was, when the universe was young, it was indeed very hot, and electrons weren't bound to protons. And at that point, it was opaque. But eventually, the universe cooled to a sufficient degree that electrons combined with protons to form neutral hydrogen atoms. And at that point, gas becomes transparent to electromagnetic radiation. Let me illustrate this. When the universe was very hot, the electrons weren't bound to the protons. That means they could easily scatter light. Light would hit an electron and just scatter into a different direction. That means that if you had an object at the left side of the screen shining light to an object at the right side of the screen, it would never get there. Or if it did get there, it would follow some zigzaggy path and you would get no clear image of the object. The universe was opaque when it was hot. But as it cooled below 3,000 degrees, electrons were able to combine with protons to form neutral, stable hydrogen atoms. And at that point, the universe became transparent, and photons were free to travel in straight lines from objects, say, at the left side to objects on the right side. You could see objects across the universe if there were any objects present at that time. There weren't, really. No structure had formed. But had there been objects present, you would be able to see them because the universe had become transparent when it reached a temperature of 3,000 degrees. Well, the microwave background photons, those waves, are coming from a time when the universe made this transition from being opaque, where all the photons were scattering around every which way, to being transparent, where they were free to traverse the universe. And so by looking back at the microwave background radiation, we're seeing back in time to when the universe was essentially an opaque wall through which one could not see. It's beyond that opaque wall at very early times that the initial density inhomogeneities must have been born that led to the birth of today's galaxies. So we have to go way back in time to study this process. How far back? To time 380,000 years. That's when the radiation was set free to travel unimpeded through the universe. It was set free when the universe was about 380,000 years old, the time of recombination of the electrons and the protons. It's like the fog was cleared at that time. Imagine being enveloped in fog. You can't see very far. Then the fog clears, and you can see distinctly objects that used to be hidden by this opaque screen. Well, the universe expanded and stretched. The optical photons became infrared and finally radio. So now they are in the microwave region of the spectrum out here. Here's the visible light. Here are gamma rays and X-rays. Microwaves are one form of radio radiation. They have a size of around a millimeter. That's the kind of radiation that your microwave oven produces, about millimeter in length, a few millimeters in length. That's the radiation that now bathes the universe, that is the afterglow of the hot Big Bang, and which proves that the universe used to be hot and dense. There is no other known origin for this uniform microwave background radiation. It was actually predicted to be present by George Gamow and two of his associates, Ralph Alpher and Robert Hermann. They predicted in the late 1940s that there should be this radiation. Penzias and Wilson discovered it in the mid-1960s, and they didn't even really realize what it is that they had discovered. Someone had to tell them. But they were careful experimentalists, and they deserved to win the Nobel Prize, and they did indeed win the Nobel Prize for this discovery. In my introductory course, I was sort of astonished that Gamow had not won the Nobel Prize for his prediction of this effect. It turns out, I've since learned, that Gamow had already died by the time the Nobel Prize was awarded, and there is a rule that it is not awarded posthumously. So that's why Gamow didn't get it. Well, there was another time when the microwave background was detected, yet not recognized for what it is, and it actually remained unrecognized for decades. It turns out that there are clouds of gas in our galaxy that have cyanogen molecules in them, a carbon atom bound to a nitrogen atom. And these cyanogen molecules look kind of like this. In the ground state, there's a carbon atom and a nitrogen atom bound together, and they're just sitting there. But there's a rotationally excited state where they can sort of tumble like that. And this rotational energy state can be excited by the cosmic microwave background radiation. Now, it turns out there are other excited states as well. There are excited vibration states where the two atoms change their distance from one another as though they're attached with a spring. And there are excited electronic transitions as well, where the electrons in these atoms are farther away from the nucleus, so they too are excited. So these are excited vibrational and electronic modes. There's also excited vibration, electronic, and rotation modes. So it gets quite complicated. This is all hairy quantum mechanics. If there were no microwave background radiation, all of the cyanogen molecules in these clouds of gas would be in the ground state. And the only possible transition would be from this ground state to this particular excited state. It turns out the laws of quantum mechanics don't allow transitions to the other states. But if you have the microwave background radiation around, then it turns out that two other possible transitions occur from this low-level state to higher-level states in this manner. Now, astronomers looked at the spectrum of a star through a cloud of gas containing cyanogen, and they saw not only the transition that would be expected if there were no microwave background radiation, in other words, the transition that occurs from the true ground state of the cyanogen molecule, but also they saw the transitions that occur from the first excited rotational state of that cyanogen molecule. Those absorption lines were seen in the spectrum of a star passing through that cloud of gas. Therefore, those cyanogen molecules must have been excited to that state. Therefore, they were being bathed in radiation that had the potential to excite them to that state. An astronomer named Adams discovered this in 1940. He attributed no particular cosmic significance to the radiation that must be bathing those cyanogen molecules. This was rediscovered several times since then, and no particular importance was ascribed to the radiation that must be bathing these cyanogen molecules, exciting them up to the first rotational level. We now understand that, in fact, the significance of these observations, or of the radiation that bathed the molecules, is that this is the afterglow from the Big Bang. Moreover, we know that that afterglow used to be hotter, because we can look at cyanogen molecules at a big redshift, say redshift 1. Back then, the universe should have been twice as hot as it is right now, it turns out, according to the equations. So instead of being only about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero, the temperature now, it should have been something like 5.4 or 5.5 degrees above absolute zero back then. This would have caused more of the cyanogen molecules to be excited up to that higher level than is the case right now. The higher the temperature of the bath of radiation bathing them, the greater is the number of these molecules that's in the higher state. Astronomers have looked at cyanogen clouds at redshift 1, and sure enough, There are more molecules in the higher excited state, meaning that the temperature of the universe used to be higher. So this microwave background radiation cannot be a local fog produced by, I don't know, radiation from stars that somehow interacts with other matter and produces a local fog. Some astronomers have suggested that. The higher temperature of the microwave background radiation at bigger redshifts proves that that could not have been the case. We also know that the radiation comes to us from very far away by looking at clusters of galaxies such as this one. This cluster of galaxies is very massive, and it has a lot of hot gas within it. That gas glows at X-ray wavelengths. Here is an image from the Chandra X-ray Observatory, named after Chandrasekhar of the famous Chandrasekhar white dwarf mass limit. The Chandra X-ray Observatory saw the hot gas in clusters of galaxies like this. And it turns out that that hot gas, interacting with microwave background photons, kicks those photons, boosts them up to a higher energy, a slightly higher energy, a shorter wavelength. That's an effect known as the Sinyaev-Zel'dovich effect, and it has been measured. The microwave background in the direction of giant clusters of galaxies like this is at a different wavelength. It's boosted to a different energy than the microwave background that's seen not in a direction toward a cluster of galaxies. So the microwave background really does originate from very, very far away. It is not a local fog. It's the afterglow of the Big Bang. Well, at some point after this emergence of the microwave background radiation at T equals 380,000 years, clumps of material must have sufficiently contracted to form galaxies, or at least bits of galaxies and stars. Back when the radiation and the matter were hitting each other a lot, back when the universe was opaque, it was hard for clumps to really coalesce into galaxies. They were just little density inhomogeneities back then. But at some point after the radiation broke free from the matter, those clumps should have coalesced to form stars and galaxies. When the first stars and galaxies were born, the dark ages came to an end, or began to come to an end. When did that happen? How did it happen? Well, we can look into the universe deeply like this and try to find the most distant, the most highly redshifted galaxy that we can. And here's one marked with an arrow, which is at a redshift of 6.6. Such a redshift corresponds to a look-back time of 12.8 billion years. Only a billion years after the birth of the universe. That's incredible. We're seeing back to just a billion years after the birth of the universe. And here are other galaxies that might be comparably distant. We don't exactly know their distances because they're so faint that spectra have not yet been taken, and we don't know the redshifts. But the redshifts are probably somewhere between 6 and 7. Well, even more astonishing, here's a quasar at a redshift of 6.4. Again, about 12.8 billion year look-back time. Quasars, as we now know, are powered by the accretion of matter onto supermassive black holes. The picture we had last time was that a quasar has this disk of material surrounding it, surrounding the black hole, feeding into the black hole. And it's this feeding process that leads to the emission of radiation. For these quasars to have existed back then, and we see lots and lots of them in the Chandra Deep Field. This is a Chandra X-ray Observatory image showing lots of quasars far, far away. For these quasars to have existed so long ago means that there must be a lot of dark matter in the universe, because without dark matter, small density inhomogeneities would have had insufficient opportunity to grow into supermassive black holes by an age of the universe of only 1 billion years. So the existence of quasars, of numerous quasars at such large distances, tells us that already there was lots of dark material gravitationally attracting clumps of material in the universe. Well, the first quasars and stars started to ionize the universe. And here's an artist's impression of what that process might have looked like. The first stars, the first quasars, emitted huge amounts of ultraviolet radiation that ionized the universe. And with time, the universe became filled with the light of stars, of galaxies being born, popping off profusely initially. The most active time of our universe in terms of star formation was the first billion years. And then since then, the star formation rate has been tapering off, as I discussed earlier. So this was an artist's simulation of what the early stages of our universe were like. The stars back then were probably massive, giant stars like these, again, in an artist's impression, because we can't actually see those first stars yet. They emitted a huge amount of ultraviolet radiation, and we think that they were more massive than typical stars today, because back then, heavy elements didn't exist. Only hydrogen and helium existed. And the heavy elements in today's stars alter the structure of those stars and make them less massive. Without the presence of those heavy elements, the natural way in which stars would have formed would have been to be more massive. These massive stars, shown here, would have emitted so much ultraviolet radiation that they would re-ionize the neutral matter in the universe. Looking at this graphic, we see all these neutral hydrogen atoms sitting around, the atoms that were formed when the universe was 380,000 years old and the electrons combined with the protons. And here are all these photons being emitted by the hot stars, some of which are ultraviolet photons, these purple things. They pass through the neutral gas and they get gobbled up by that gas. The electrons gobble up the ultraviolet photons, becoming released from the protons and forming just a jumble of free protons and electrons. And now notice the ultraviolet photons are missing, or largely missing, because they've been eaten by these neutral atoms. The universe became re-ionized after the end of the Dark Ages by the birth of all these stars, quasars, and galaxies. It went through a stage of re-ionization. When did this happen? At what stage did it happen? Well, as I said, one way to figure it out is to go back and find the earliest stars, the earliest galaxies. But another way has been to use properties of the microwave background radiation itself. There's been an amazing satellite in orbit the past year, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, which I've already mentioned and which I will discuss in more detail in Lecture 13. But let me give you a preview today. This Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe showed that certain detailed properties of the radiation were affected by scattering of that radiation by the free electrons that were produced during this stage of reionization. The free electrons did affect the microwave background photons to some degree, but the universe was now sufficiently extended, of sufficiently low density, that most photons were able to travel unimpeded. Right? So the universe was no longer completely opaque, as it was when it was first born, but also no longer completely transparent, as it was when the atoms were fully neutral. There was some scattering after this era of reionization, enough scattering that it could be detected by the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, but not so much scattering that it causes our universe to be opaque since the time of reionization. That's a pretty tough concept, but I'm trying to show you how the universe behaved when it was very, very young. Well, in this last graphic, let me show you what we see when we look back in time with these great telescopes. The Hubble Space Telescope can look far back in time at old galaxies, that is, galaxies when the universe was quite young. The James Webb Space Telescope in the future will be able to look back even further with greater clarity. WMAP, the Microwave Anisotropy Probe, looks back and effectively sees the ignition of the first stars. And farther back still, the W map looks back at the time when the first light was emitted. Between that time when the first light was emitted, 380,000 years after the Big Bang, and the time when the first stars ignited, 200 million years after the Big Bang, those are the dark ages, and we're beginning to get some grip on what the universe behaved like during those times.